Okay, I'm Jim Horner at West Virginia University, and this is joint work with Mark Loback. We have a small group of five people, actually, called RC2, or RC squared AI. Turns out that using AI as a domain is not as easy as you think, because AI belongs to an island in the Caribbean, and you have to negotiate to get that domain. So at this point, we have RC squared RC2 AI.io, which I guess captures AI and IO. So I want to talk about running R and Spark and Docker containers. And I'm going to come to that other slide in just a moment. So in outline, I'm going to give a brief introduction. I'm going to talk about R Spark, which is another initiative, and I'll explain why I'm doing that. And then I'll talk about the RC squared server and client. So, this doesn't quite fit, does it? The two principal big data architectures, the way I see it at least, is HDFS and Hadoop. And that's a framework for distributed storage and distributed processing using MapReduce. Spark is sort of the up-and-coming kid, and it's a very fast kid in terms of its movement over the last few years. It's a cluster computing environment using in-memory primitives rather than Hadoop's two-stage and disk-based approach. However, you can actually use HDFS for storage for Spark, and if you really want to scale it and you don't want to be memory constrained, that's the way you should do it. There are other ways to do it also. Now, these environments are part of a very large ecosystem, both of them. Over the years, Hadoop has been around for quite a while now, and it has a very large ecosystem. Unfortunately, its sort of default machine running library is not all that great, MalAlt, and I think you had some improvements over that. Spark, I've gone to the last three Spark summits, and they typically, this year I think they had 3,000, and they had to move it from the Hilton in downtown San Francisco to Moscone Center. And it's growing very rapidly. And it's sort of encompassing everything. So its ecosystem is growing very rapidly, and 2.2 was announced at Spark Summit. The big thing there is streaming. They've had streaming in many batches, but now streaming essentially has zero latency in the new version of Spark. They tend to encompass everything that you can now, in development, run it with TensorFlow, for example, using GPU processing. And now, what do people use as a front-end language? Well, you might think, since Hadoop was written in Java, that that's what you would use, but most people didn't like Java, and so Python came along very strongly, and increasingly R. Now, Spark was written in Scala, which is a JVM language and compatible with Java, but it's much like Apple Swift. It's a hybrid, object-oriented, functional language. The code you write for Scala is much, much more condensed than Java. And I'm going to show you a couple slides. This is an O'Reilly publication, and I was having internet connections last night at my hotel, and so it's one of those free internet things. It has to do with streaming data that O'Reilly gives out. And so this is a batch architecture, and this is sort of what people did maybe 5 years ago, sort of ancient history. So you basically have to get data in some place, and so you may have a database here, and you could use something to modulate it like Squap, which brings it into like HDFS or maybe S3. Or into a SQL or NoSQL databases, or perhaps into a data warehouse like Hive that's built on HDFS. If you have something that's more streaming-like, like logs, you have Fume available, which again, Fume modulates things to bring it into HDFS. And then you have this resource manager, and you may have lots of nodes. So you have a resource manager and a node manager called Yarn. And then from that, you can run Spark in batch mode, and you can run things like MapReduce. So this is the batch architecture. So next you have the streaming architecture. Things get a little bit more complex here. So how do you get data in? Well, typically now you need something like Kafka to act sort of, that's the intermediary between that and your persistent store like HDFS or S3, or again, NoSQL databases. And you can actually work with sockets or logs, various ways. You can bring in streaming data and again modulate it so it can come into HDFS in a permitted store. But the big thing now is also microservices. You have whole companies built around this, like MuleSoft in San Francisco. That they're building these, they let you glue all these components together and build these workflows. And you have systems like ZooKeeper for configuration and other reasons. But now Kafka can send it directly to streaming data. And so you have Kafka Streams, or you have Flink, which is actually a competitor of Spark from Germany, I believe. Are there any Flink people here? So. At any rate, now Spark Streaming, I have many batches. This is out of date, because as of June, last month, you have Spark 2.2, which does very fast Spark streaming with essentially zero latency. And of course, you still have batch Spark with Hadoop and so forth. So now the question I would raise is this. How do you build these systems? And here's the more important question. How do you integrate all the components such that all the versions match? How do you update the systems? What about pre-processing? I would suggest that the future might be in containerization. You may have heard of Docker. If you haven't, you will. Docker containers, they can containerize the components of your system. That's not enough, though, in itself, if you really want to scale it up. You need something like Kubernetes or Mesos. You need some environment that orchestrates these containers to do production at scale. So the combination of what we're using is Docker and Kubernetes. Now, I had to teach a course, and so how do I teach? And by the way I think about data science is a little bit different than a lot of statisticians think about it. I am a statistician. But to me, if you're just doing machine learning on a machine, that's not data science. You're not going to get hired as a data scientist if you don't know how to use systems like Spark in database computing, like with Oracle and so forth. And you need to know SQL if you want a job in these big data companies. So ArcSpark lets you experiment, and this just basically it was a system I sort of put together so I could teach some short courses this fall, and also a regular course. And right now ArcSpark runs on a single machine, although it can be a server, and so it can have a lot of cores. And in principle, it could have a lot of GPU units. Now, for this, our studio is a web-based client. Now, this has a deployment issue, and this is important to realize. When you spin up these containers, they're spinning up in parallel. But you may have dependency relationships among your containers. For example, Hive cannot really launch until HDFS does, or you get into trouble. And so Docker doesn't really have a way of knowing what you're doing and knowing that this container has to complete before you can start the next. That's one of the reasons we started RC Squared, is because we can control the whole spin-up process of these containers. So this is, by the way, if you go back to this, if you want to experiment with RSpark, that's the GitHub. It's just RSpark under my name, Jay Harner. And then RC2 server is where you can get most of this. But we're going to move it to RC2 AI in the very near future. Everything will be there. It's a four-tier architecture, RC Squared. It has a client, which right now is native Swift for macOS and iOS. I say it's planned, we actually have it in progress. A web-based version which will run anywhere. We have and this is the canonical part that you always have to have. You can put other pieces with it like Spark and so forth, but you need an app server. You have to have your client talk to something. That used to be written in Java, and these all run in Linux, by the way, in the containers. So we've switched over to Swift, because Swift is becoming extremely good for Linux distributions now. And the code base is about a tenth the size of what you need for Java. And it's faster and more modern. We're using WebSockets and RESTkit for communications. The compute instance is JSON over BSD sockets. And then we have two databases with SUNET running by default. One is PostgreSQL, and that is for storing files. Everything gets stored in databases, the data or data files as blobs and so forth. We also use CouchDB for a NoSQL key value database for logging JSON messages. Now these run in Linux containers. This is the architecture. You basically have a client and you have the Swift that spins up multiple sessions. So let's say in session two, that's where I am, let's say. It connects to what's called an R session. And I have another slide that explains this a little bit more. It can be multiple R sessions. And actually, there can be multiple clients going into the same R session, which allows collaboration. Now down here, the R sessions can be containerized, and you can run, we aren't doing this yet, but we're experimenting. You can run with Kubernetes, you can run a bunch of these R sessions containerized over a large computer environment. Now we can also spin up a Spark cluster, containerized, virtualized, and that can be as large as you want. It can be on a single server, or it can be across a real cluster. But again, it's all virtualized. So this gives a little bit more explanation. For example, the R compute part is actually written in C++, and it forks R sessions. And I'm just giving a little more detail about these four pieces. These should be posted, I guess, on the web. So I actually want to show you what this looks like. And this is a little more information on the databases we're using. Now, HDFS is separate. And one of the key things you have to know about HDFS, because you were mentioning not moving data, you don't want to move data, you can do that in a couple ways. One of them is in-database computing. And there's no reason why we can't spin up a PostgreSQL far embedded in it and do in-database computing. You can spin up containers to do anything. You just have to make sure the version numbers work correctly with everything. HDFS has data locality. Basically, it fixes the data distributed across the cluster, and it brings the compute power to the data. That's called data locality. If you have to move the data, you've lost the game. If you have in-memory processing, which Spark does by default, but you can do it in HDFS, again, if you have too many users, as you mentioned, your performance will not be so good. So you ought to be able to switch from in-memory systems to HDFS based on the load. I'm going to come back to this. This is sort of, if you type in, you make a change in a file, how does this propagate through the system? What I'd like to do is actually show you to you. This is the client interface. On the left, you have the code, and on the right, you have the output. Now, we wrote this. We said, okay, you really ought to be able to do this on an iPhone. Because you're controlling resources wherever. You could be walking around. You should be able to control it. So right now, it's in landscape. On an iOS device, we actually can stack them. But you're probably going to want to do it in landscape mode. And the iOS is slightly different than this. But basically, we have a slide out. And that's showing the files in this particular session. So here I have a file, and I can execute it. And if I run it, I get the output. But I can go back and look at the log. Now, I've run a few other things, which is why you see some things there. Now, suppose I want to look at the .or data. So I can simply click here. And then I could hover over things, and it actually brings up the structure. So this is actually, it brings up the structure as you hover over it. If you have packages, and let's say you want to find the mean, so I could say mean, and so these are the packages that have mean functions, so I could click on mean, and therefore I get, in the right-hand panel, I get the help file, right beside your code where you need it. Of course, you could also get it by clicking on plot, and that brings up the help here. Now on this side, again, this takes you back to the console. If you have graphs, they're here. That was a previous run, and here. This actually brings up the help file. I can search anywhere, so if I want to search here, it brings up a search field. I can search on this side if I change the focus. That lets me search. Now, you also need something, and this may crash, so I saved it for last. You also need a couple things. And by the way, you can do contextual things. So for example, if I click here, I can do all the previous chunks. I can do the current chunk. I can do all that kind of stuff. Now, the interface we're building that will be right above the chunk, we're not using exactly the type of interface our studio uses because it's too small. If you were doing iOS devices, you can't hit those little tiny things on a small tablet. So we're going to put a band across, and so it is tablet friendly with your finger, even if you don't have a stylus. But at any rate, so we're architecting a little bit different, but it's the same concept. Let me just, there are two other things I want to show you, and this may crash it, but so the Docker container, so how do you manage the containers? Now this allows you to do backups, but here are this only has three containers running. Now you may have Spark and a bunch of other things. So those are the containers, you can start them and stop them. So if one of them didn't start up correctly, you can restart it. If you have bugs, you can go to the logs. And you can look for each container. Remember, each of these is a small Linux system. So you can go look at the logs for that particular container to see. So in other words, we're building a whole management for your containers. And the idea is that in the future, you'll be able to, if you're already running containers, you'll be able to start up new containers and connect to them automatically. So the container management is extremely important. If you do the Wild West, now our Spark, which I showed you earlier, is sort of the Wild West. It's sort of a race to make sure that the correct ones, I have to put things to pause and say, okay, I need a little more time for this container because it has to be launched before another one. And so in this case, we check that. We don't let containers launch until they're ready. Until they're dependent, you know, if they're dependent on other ones, they have to launch first. So that's the kind of stuff that we're doing. And personally, we're trying to design a clean interface that works on small tablet type devices. So there's a few other things I didn't say in the talk, but I have pictures. Oh, this is a startup screen. And that startup screen on the right, you can click on different environments that are predetermined, and you can actually be running in them tabs. You can be running multiple versions. You might run one locally, one on a server, and one on a cluster. They can all be running at once, and you can monitor them all. So I have a bunch of these. So I'll stop here.